Good afternoon, good evening, good morning in some parts of the world. This is, of course, John St. Germain, the Minister Sinister, as I'm known in certain parts of the world. And tonight we're having a nice surprise for you. Anything goes. I did not plan the show at all. And I decided that what I was going to do is 10 minutes before the show, reach into my box of spiritual books and pulling out, and I swore a sacred oath to the universe that whatever book I pulled out, we would be doing readings from tonight. Well, the universe, being what it is, rather surprised me. And what I pulled out, I'll announce in just a minute. And until then, enjoy our musical number for the night, which I think should set the tone for the rather wacky proceedings to follow. So we'll be right back.
Woman's into astrology. She's hooked on planetology. She forgot about sexology. She needs a little psychology. Whenever I feel like I want to make love, she's thinking about the stars above. I'm ready and willing to go all the way, but she says the aspects are wrong today. She says my moon's an I've got the incorrect delineation. Whenever I'm thinking about recreation, she's dreaming about some damn constellation. She's always somewhere getting a reading. I want to get physical, that's what I'm needing. I gotta talk to her heart to heart. All she can talk about is her astrology chart. And for that I'm begging, but she's just like that Nancy Reagan. Whenever I feel like I want to get wiggly, she says, stop a minute, it's too quickly. I want to kiss her and hold her tighter. She got to read a book by Carol Ryder. Joyce, Jilson, Sidney Lumar, Arthur Chadbourne, too. I'm going crazy, wouldn't you? She's obsessed with all this planetary protocol. I'm telling you, man, it's gonna drive me up the wall. Our stars are in the incorrect formation. I've gotta go and get me a rectification. Whenever I feel like getting amorous, she's looking up stuff in her ephemeris. She's gotta figure out some planet's places. I'm telling you, man, that chick's outrageous. Yeah, she's going on astrology. She's hooked on planetology. She forgot about sexology. She needs a whole lot of psychology.
Well, that, of course, is the astrology rap. Artist unknown. I think it was Dr. Demento or somebody. Tonight our topic is Anything Goes, and I reached into my spiritual box of books. I have several of those, several crates, and I swore a sacred oath upon the universe to read excerpts from whatever I pull out. But before we do that, before we unearth this surprise, let's do our crystal of the night, which of course is crystal of the week, which of course is peacock ore, very beautiful thing. And peacock ore is borsite or chalcopyrite, because it's a mixture of copper and iron, copper and pyrite. And the mixture of that, of course, combines the qualities of both elements, but also it's a multicolored stone. It literally runs the gamut of the spectrum. And as with many, many of the spectral stones, the multispectral stones, it creates a unique energy. The color vibration is everywhere. And every stone that you buy, every peacock stone that you find, is different. So I think it's important, like with all your stones, to be able to have a selection to go where you can put your hands on them and touch them and find one that you like. It's a very versatile stone for healing work and energy work. It's a stone that, because of its versatility, it can enhance inner knowledge of yourself. It can strengthen your perception on all aspects of experience, and it can help you refine your sensitivities to the point where you can trust all the things all the things that you perceive, rather than the senses can be very deceiving, and Peacock Stone can help you refine your perceptions to where you can more or less trust what you see. It's good for any exercises involving chi, moving the chi, Tai Chi, for instance, any of the practices where you help move chi throughout your body. It can be used in, to help elevate your mood. It'll help you tune into the into the positive forces that work in your life and neglect or overlook overemphasis on the negative. It has a unique quality in chakra balancing. If you put it on one chakra, it will balance them all. Anywhere you touch with it will spread to the others. You can cleanse, you can balance, you can align, discharge, etc., every chakra one by one with a single piece of stone. It will it can transform the negative energies that clog up your chakras into a more positive flow. You usually use it in physical healing and in things involving the stomach, the lungs, and anything involving inflammation. There's quite a bit on this. In fact, my notebook is filled with stuff like this. It can help you start all over again, reborn, reboot. It can help unify you with the spirit. Eliminate the whole idea of duality, that there's me and spirit. You realize that you are one with the spirit. And it can help you if you tend to be overly perfectionistic. It gives you a more realistic view of yourself. So that is our wonderful peacock ore, which of course people found it in the ground and said, "Hey, this looks like a peacock tail," and that's how it got its name. Not the most ingenious name. It's like how salt was invented. People tasted salt and said, "Hey, this tastes salty," so that's how salt got its name. Dwell on that for a minute. This is Crystal Silence League Hour. I'm John St. Germain. Of course, we are sponsored by Lucky Mojo Curio Company and LMC Radio Network. And you can visit us on the web at www.crystalsilenceleague.org, where prayer is always free. Hundreds of people, and I'm not exaggerating, hundreds of people post prayers there on a daily basis. And you can always go and post your prayer. They're posted anonymously. And people will go there and click on a little button that says, I've prayed for you. And you'll get an email that that has that affirmation. The Crystal Silence League was formed in 1917 or so by Claude Alexander Conlon, a magical adept, for the purpose of spreading positive prayer and affirmation to all in need. And it was refounded on the Internet by the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church a few years ago. So do come join us. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, which mostly goes out every month, and I'm the editor of that, so it's kind of like this radio program. You never know what you're going to get. The newsletter is also free if you subscribe to it. We have lots of good information in that. What else? Crystal Silence League, newsletter, a very good organization to be a member of. You can also buy crystal balls and crystals for study, and there are two books by Mr. Conlon on the use of crystal balls for projection and attraction, healing, and mediumship. And with the purchase of a crystal ball of $5 or more, you get one of these books free of your choice. You can also buy them from us if you like. I think they're $5 each, and it's quite a bargain. And I'm currently working on another book for the Crystal Silence League, the first, I think, that's been written since the 20s. On the four branches of crystal gazing. It's our custom to begin the program with a public prayer. I download and print some of the prayers from the Crystal Silence League, and I read these aloud, and they're always identified anonymously only by prayer ID. We don't use names. And so if you will, just join me for a few minutes in prayer for the following people. And this is prayer ID number 42536, CA, who prays that one of his biggest wishes will be fulfilled this Saturday. Well, I hope your wish comes true. And prayer ID number 42535, RI, wants prayers to help him find and date women. And if prayer can help you find and date women, sir, I hope our prayers will help you. Prayer ID number 42532, DZ, needs protection from danger. There are apparently bad work environment, and she needs protection from hostility at work. Prayer ID number 42531, HG, needs her Medicaid to cover her medical bills. And prayer ID number 42530, JK, prays that the Lord God helps heal M from her partial blindness, heart failure, and weakness, and sends her angels and caring people in her final days. Prayer ID number 42529, family and this person, she says, this family and I are in need of a financial blessing. Husband's on disability, and she had to quit her job because of bad health, and there's a whole lot of financial woes, and they need a financial blessing. Prayer ID number 42528, SH, needs to find favor with the bank for a $4,000 loan to expand her business. And prayer ID number 42527, AA, needs a steady, safe, and comfortable living situation and to work out something successfully with his or her partner. Prayer ID number 42526, MO, needs finances to pay for the house and bills and to finance his or her business. And prayer ID number 42524, RV, thanks the full moon for her aid in granting her wishes and prays that she continues to shine her love on me. Okay. Prayer ID number 42523, SC, prays for financial assistance, for guidance, and for stability. Prayer ID number 42522, GD, prays for his or her son, S, who's having financial hardship and being taken advantage of by people. He's becoming more and more despondent, and the petitioner fears for his or her son's peace of mind and fears that his or her son may be becoming suicidal. So he or she, I can't tell, prays for God to protect the son. So let's all pray that this works out all right and that her son, his or her son, works through this. Prayer ID number 42520, TM, prays for fast money. Prayer ID number 42517, prays for help, and it's anonymous, so his or her college education. And we have one more. Prayer ID number 42521 prays for that he or she will be exceptionally successful in her college courses and receive A's on all of her paper. May all these prayers be considered by the great and benevolent spirits, and may all sentient beings be at peace. So let's take just a moment of silence for all those in need of prayer and positive thought. Amen. Well, the great and benevolent universe has decided tonight, decided anything goes, and I was going to reach into my book, of my box of sacred volumes and manuscripts, scrolls, and tablets, and pull something out from which I was going to read excerpts tonight. So imagine my surprise when, at the end of this, and I swore a sacred vow that whatever I grabbed, I would read. This is so that I wouldn't pull out something of my personal favorite, like a dummy's, idiot's guide to Buddhism or something. And to my surprise, I pulled out Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s last book, Timequake. And so tonight we'll be reading excerpts with probably an occasional commentary from Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s last novel, Timequake. And the premise of Timequake was that everybody in the world experienced a hiccup in time and went back 10 years in time and had to relive the past 10 years. Unfortunately, they relived it with full knowledge that they were reliving the past 10 years, and they knew exactly what was going to happen along the way. Free will utterly gone, forced to relive and react and re-say and redo everything that they did in the past 10 years. It was very close to being consigned in hell. So let us begin this reading, and we're going to consider this a sacred spiritual text, since that is exactly the way the universe intended it. So let's glean it for secret meaning and spiritual lessons. So it begins as follows, the prologue. Ernest Hemingway, in 1952, published in Life magazine a short story called The Old Man in the Sea. It was about a Cuban fisherman who hadn't caught anything for 84 days. The Cuban hooked an enormous marlin. He killed it and lashed it alongside his little boat. Before he could get it to shore, though, sharks bit off all the meat on the skeleton. I was living in Barnstable Village on Cape Cod when the story appeared. I asked a neighboring commercial fisherman what he thought of it. He said, "The hero was an idiot. He should have hacked off the best chunks of meat and put them in the bottom of the boat and left the rest of the carcass for the sharks." It could be that the sharks Hemingway had in mind were critics who hadn't much liked his first novel in 10 years, Across the River and Into the Trees, published 2 years earlier. As far as I know, he never said so, but the marlin could have been that novel. And then I found myself in the winter of 1996, the creator of a novel which did not work, which had no point, which had never wanted to be written in the first place. Merde. I had spent nearly a decade on that ungrateful fish, if you will. It wasn't even fit for shark chum. I'd recently turned 73. My mother made it to 52. My father to 72. Hemingway almost made it to 62. I'd lived too long. What was I to do? Answer, fillet the fish. Throw the rest away. This I did in the summer and autumn of 1996. Yesterday, November 11th of that year, I turned 74. 74! Johannes Brahms quit composing symphonies when he was 55. Enough! My architect father was sick and tired of architecture when he was 55. Enough! American male novelists have done their best work by then. Enough! 55 is a long time ago for me now. Have pity. My great big fish, which stunk so, was entitled Timequake. Let us think of it as Timequake 1, and let us think of this one as stew made from its best parts mixed with thoughts and experiences during the past 7 months or so as Timequake 2. Okay? The premise of Timequake 1 was that a timequake, a sudden glitch in the space-time continuum, made everybody and everything do exactly what they'd done during a past decade, for good or ill, a second time. It was deja vu that wouldn't quit for 10 long years. You couldn't complain about life's being nothing but old stuff, or ask if you were just going nuts, or if everybody was going nuts. There was absolutely nothing you could say during the rerun if you hadn't said it the first time through the decade. You couldn't even save your own life or that of a loved one if you had failed to do that in the first time through. I had the timequake zap everyone and everything back an instant from February 13, 2001, back to February 17, 1991. And we all had to get back to 2001 the hard way, minute by minute, hour by hour, year by year, betting on the wrong horse, marrying the wrong person again, getting the clap again, you name it. Only when people got back to when the timequake hit did they stop being robots of their past. As the old science fiction writer Kilgore Trout said, only when free will kicked in again could they stop running obstacle courses of their own construction. Trout doesn't really exist. He's been my alter ego in several of my other novels, but most of what I have chosen to preserve from Timequake 1 has to do with his adventures and opinions. I have salvaged a few of the thousands of stories he wrote between 1931, when he was 14, and 2001, when he died at the age of 84. A hobo for much of his life, he died in luxury in the Ernest Hemingway suite of the Writer's Retreat Xanadu in the summer resort village of Point Zion, Rhode Island. That's nice to know. His very first story, he told me as he was dying, was set in Camelot, the court of King Arthur in Britain. Merlin, the court magician, casts a spell that allows him to equip the Knights of the Round Table with Thompson submachine guns and drums of 45 caliber dum-dums. Sir Galahad, the purest in heart and mind, familiarizes himself with this new virtue-compelling appliance. While doing so, he puts a slug through the Holy Grail and makes a Swiss cheese of Queen Guinevere. Here's what Trout said when he realized the 10-year rerun was over, that he and everybody else were suddenly obligated to think of new stuff to do, to be creative again. Oh, Lordy, I'm much too old and experienced to start playing Russian roulette with free will again. Yes, and I myself was a character in Timequake 1, making a cameo appearance at a clam bake on the beach at a writer's retreat Xanadu in the summer of 2001, 6 months after the end of the rerun, 6 months after free will kicked in again. I was there with several fictitious persons from the book, including Kilgore Trout. I was privileged to hear the old, long, out-of-print science fiction writer describe for us and then demonstrate the special place of Earthlings in the cosmic scheme of things. So now my last book is done, with the exception of this preface. Today is November 12, 1996, about 9 months, I would guess, from its publication date, from its emergence from the birth canal of a printing press. There's no rush. The gestation period for a baby Indian elephant is more than twice that long. The gestation period for a baby opossum friends and neighbors is 12 days. I pretended in this book that I will still be alive for the clam bake in 2001. In chapter 46.1, I imagine myself as still alive in 2010. Sometimes I say I'm in 1996, where I really am, and sometimes I say I'm in the midst of a rerun following a Timequake without making clear distinctions between the two situations. I must be nuts. Call me Junior. My 6 grown kids do. They're adopted nephews, 3 of my own. They call me Junior behind my back. They think I don't know that. I say in speeches that a plausible mission of artists is to make people appreciate being alive at least a little bit. I am then asked if I know of any artists who pulled that off. I reply, the Beatles did. It appears to me that the most highly evolved earthling creatures find being alive embarrassing or much worse. Never mind cases of extreme discomfort, such as idealists being crucified. Two important women in my life, my mother and my only sister Alice, or Allie, in heaven now, hated life and said so. Allie would cry out, I give up! I give up! The funniest American of his time, Mark Twain, found life for himself and everybody else so stressful when he was in his 70s, like me, that he wrote as follows, I have never wanted any released friend of mine restored to life since I reached manhood. That is in an essay on the sudden death of his daughter, Jean, a few days earlier. Among those he wouldn't have resurrected were Jean and another daughter, Susie, and his beloved wife and his best friend, Henry Rogers. Twain didn't live to see World War I, but still he felt that way. Jesus said how awful life was in the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are they that mourn, and blessed are the meek, and blessed are they who do hunger and thirst after righteousness. Henry David Thoreau said most famously, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. So it is not one whit mysterious that we poison the water and air and topsoil and construct ever more cunning doomsday devices, both industrial and military. Let us be perfectly frank for a change. For practically everybody, the end of the world can't come soon enough. My father, Kurt Sr., an Indianapolis architect who had cancer and whose wife had committed suicide some 15 years earlier, was arrested for running a red light in his hometown. It turned out that he hadn't had a driver's license for 20 years. You know what he told the arresting officer? So shoot me, he said. The African-American jazz pianist Fats Waller had a sentence he used to shout when his playing was absolutely brilliant and hilarious. This was it. Somebody shoot me while I'm happy. That there are such devices as firearms, as easy to operate as cigarette lighters, and as cheap as toasters, capable at anybody's whim of killing Father or Fats or Abraham Lincoln or John Lennon or Martin Luther King Jr. or a woman pushing a baby carriage should be proof enough for anybody that, to quote the old science fiction writer Kilgore Trout, quote, being alive is a crock of shit, unquote. Imagine this. A great American university gives up football in the name of sanity. It turns its vacant stadium into a bomb factory. So much for sanity. Shades of Kilgore Trout. I'm speaking of my alma mater, the University of Chicago. In December of 1942, long before I got there, the first chain reaction of uranium on Earth was compelled by scientists underneath the stands of Stagg Field. Their intent was to demonstrate the feasibility of an atomic bomb. We were at war with Germany and Japan. 53 years later, on August 6, 1995, there was a gathering in the chapel of my university to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the detonation of the first atomic bomb over the city of Hiroshima, Japan. I was there. One of the speakers was the physicist Leo Sarin. He had participated in the successful experiment under the Lifeless Sports Facility so long ago. Get this, he apologized for having done that. Somebody should have told him that being a physicist on a planet where the smartest animals hate being alive so much means never having to say you're sorry. Now imagine this. A man creates a hydrogen bomb for a paranoid Soviet Union, makes sure it will work, and then wins a Nobel Peace Prize. This real-life character, worthy of a story by Kilgore Trout, was the late physicist Andrei Sakharov. He won his Nobel in 1975 for demanding a halt to the testing of nuclear weapons. He, of course, had already tested his. His wife was a pediatrician. What sort of person could perfect a hydrogen bomb while married to a child care specialist? What sort of physician would stay with a mate that cracked? Anything interesting happen at work today, honey bunch? Yes, my bomb is going to work just great. And how are you doing with that kid with chicken pox? Andrei Sakharov was a sort of a saint in 1975, a sort that is no longer celebrated now that the Cold War is over. He was a dissident in the Soviet Union. He called for an end to the development and testing of nuclear weapons, and also for more freedoms for his people. He was kicked out of the USSR's Academy of Sciences. He was exiled from Moscow to a whistle stop on the permafrost. He was not allowed to go to Oslo to receive his peace prize. His pediatrician wife, Elena Bonner, accepted it for him. But isn't it time for us to ask now if she or any pediatrician or healer wasn't more deserving of a peace prize than anyone who had a hand in creating an H-bomb for any kind of government anywhere? Human rights, what could be more indifferent to the rights of any form of life than an H-bomb? Sakharov was in June of 1987 awarded an honorary doctorate by Staten Island College in New York City. Once again, his government wouldn't let him accept in person, so I was asked to do that for him. All I had to do was deliver a message he had sent. This was it. Quote, don't give up on nuclear energy, unquote. I spoke it like a robot. I was so polite. But this was one year after this crazy planet's most deadly nuclear calamity so far at Chernobyl, Ukraine. Children all over Northern Europe will be sickened or worse for years to come by that release of radiation. Plenty of work for pediatricians. More heartening to me than Sakharov's cockamamie exhortation was the behavior of firemen in Schenectady, New York, after Chernobyl. I used to work in Schenectady. The firemen sent a letter to their brother firemen over there congratulating them on their courage and selflessness while trying to save lives and property. Hooray for firemen! Scum of the earth, as some of them may be in their daily lives, they can all be saints in emergencies. Hooray for firemen! In Timequake 1, Kilgore Trout wrote a story about an atom bomb. Because of the time quake, he had to write it twice. The 10-year rerun following the time quake, remember, made him and me and you and everyone else do everything we'd done from February 17, 1991 to February 12, 2001, a second time. Trout didn't mind writing it again. Rerun or not, he could tune out the crock of shit being alive was as long as he was scribbling head down with a ballpoint pen on a yellow legal pad. He called the story No Laughing Matter. He threw it away before anybody else could see it, and then had to throw it away again during the rerun. At the clam bake at the... Pardon me, I inhaled to fly. At the end of Timequake 1, in the summer of the year 2001, after free will kicked in again, Trout said this about all the stories he had torn to pieces and flushed down toilets or tossed into trash-strewn vacant lots or whatever. Easy come, easy go. No Laughing Matter got its title from what a judge in the story said during a top-secret court-martial of the crew of the American bomber Joy's Pride on the Pacific island of Honolulu 1 month after the end of World War II. Joy's Pride itself was perfectly okay, and in the hangar there on Honolulu, it was named in honor of the pilot's mother, Joy Peterson, a nurse in obstetrics in a hospital in Corpus Christi, Texas. Pride had a double meaning. It meant self-respect. It meant a lion family, too. Here's the thing. After an atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and then another one was dropped on Nagasaki, Joy's Pride was ordered to drop yet another one on Yokohama, on a couple of million little yellow bastards, in quotes. The little yellow bastards were called little yellow bastards back then. It was wartime. Trout described the third atom bomb like this, quote, a purple motherfucker as big as a boiler in the basement of a mid-sized junior high school, unquote. It was too big to fit inside the bomb bay. It was slung underneath the plane's belly and cleared the runway by a foot when Joy's Pride took off into the wild blue yonder. As the plane neared its target, the pilot mused out loud on the intercom that his mother, the obstetrics nurse, would be a celebrity back home after they did what they were about to do. The bomber Enola Gay and the woman in whose honor it was named had become as famous as movie stars after it dropped its load on Hiroshima. Yokohama was twice as populous as Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. The more the pilot thought about it, though, the surer he was this sweet widowed mother could never tell reporters she was happy that her son's airplane had killed a world's record number of civilians all at once. Trout's story reminds me of the time my late great-aunt Emma Vonnegut said she hated the Chinese. Her late son-in-law, Kerfuet Stewart, who used to own Stewart's Bookstore in Louisville, Kentucky, admonished her that it was wicked to hate that many people all at once. Whatever. The crewmen aboard Joy's Pride, at any rate, told the pilot on the intercom that they felt much as he did. They were all alone up there in the sky. They didn't need a fighter escort, since the Japanese didn't have any airplanes left. The war was over, except for the paperwork, arguably the situation even before Enola Gay cremated Hiroshima. To quote Kilgore Trout, this wasn't war anymore, and neither had been the obliteration of Nagasaki. This was thanks to the Yanks for a job well done. This was showbiz now. Trout said in No Laughing Matter that the pilot and his bombardier had felt somewhat godlike on previous missions, when they had nothing more than incendiaries and conventional high explosives to drop on people. But that was godlike with a little g, he wrote. They identified themselves with minor deities who only avenged and destroyed. Up there in the sky all day alone, with the purple motherfucker slung underneath their plane, they felt like the boss god himself, who had an option which hadn't been theirs before, which was to be merciful. Trout himself had been in World War II, but not as an airman and not in the Pacific. He had been a forward observer for the Army Field Artillery in Europe, a lieutenant in binoculars and a radio, up with the infantry, or even ahead of it. He would tell batteries to the rear whether shrapnel or white phosphorus or whatever it might help a lot. He himself had certainly not been merciful, nor by his own account had he ever felt he should have been. I asked him at the Clam Bake in 2001 at the Writers' Retreat Xanadu what he'd done during the war, which he called civilization's second unsuccessful attempt to commit suicide. He said without a scintilla of regret, I made sandwiches of German soldiers between an erupting earth and an exploding sky and in a blizzard of razor blades. The pilot of Joy's Pride made a U-turn way up in the sky. The purple motherfucker was still slung underneath. The pilot headed back for Honolulu. He did it, wrote Trout, because that is what his mother would have wanted him to do. At the top-secret court-martial afterward, everybody was convulsed with laughter at one point in the proceedings. This caused the chief judge to bang his gavel and declare that what those on trial had done was no laughing matter. What people found so funny was the prosecutor's description of what people did at the base when Joy's Pride came in for a landing with the purple motherfucker only a foot above the tarmac. People jumped out of windows. They peed in their pants. There were all kinds of collisions between different kinds of vehicles, wrote Kilgore Trout. No sooner had the judge restored order, though, than a huge crack opened in the floor of the Pacific Ocean. It swallowed Honolulu, court-martial, Joy's Pride, unused atom bomb, and all. We are going to take a break for station identification, and we will return back from readings of our sacred text, Timequake, by Kurt Vonnegut, Jr.
You are listening to the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. The longest-running conjure show in the universe, it may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time, Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa. This is the meeting place for all esoteric traditions. Candelo brings his insight as a Polero and eclectic spiritualist to his interviews with peers in Afro-Caribbean lineages, as well as representatives of numerous other spiritualities and religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. Tuesdays bring two wonderful shows to suit your taste. After the spiritual boost provided by the Reverend John St. Germain during the Crystal Silence League Hour, stay tuned for In the Streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly provides up-to-the-minute reports on civil and social rights issues. Her one-hour show airs on Tuesday evenings at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Wednesday nights, come out and join Liquid Libations. Andrea Weston hosts this informal sharing and showcasing of poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances, contributed by novices and professional wordsmiths. Call in and read your work. Liquid Libations may be heard on Wednesdays from 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the professor shares his knowledge of roots, delivers the lucky numbers, and explores the secrets of scriptural sorcery. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. And on Saturdays, Kai Armand broadcasts On Sacred Ground, a tapestry of our times comprising history, ethnography, and shamanism, featuring the voices of the land and the deceased, aided by scholars, spirit workers, and environmentalists. Kai's show airs from noon to 1:30 p.m. Pacific Time. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern, tax and license may apply, train departure times and Burma shape signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
There's certainly no end to the surprises as far as this person is concerned. Tonight, we are reading from Time Quake by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., and it seems to me that this has been an appropriate selection. If you read between the lines, we have covered many, many topics of interest and copacetic with our last programs, in fact. Happiness, spirituality, ethics, and all sorts of stuff. So let us continue. And I think I've succeeded in digesting that fly, but its aftermath still lingers. You ought to try to read with a fly in your throat. It's not easy, but I am a superhuman being when it comes to reading literature. Let's continue. When excellent German novelist and graphic artist Günter Grass heard that I was born in 1922, he said to me, "There are no males in Europe your age for you to talk to." He himself was a kid during Kilgore Trouts and my war, as were Elie Wiesel and Jerzy Kolinski and Milos Forman, and on and on. I was lucky to be born over here instead of over there, and white, and middle class, and into a house full of books and pictures, and into a large extended family, which exists no more. I heard the poet Robert Pinsky give a reading this summer, in which he apologized didactically for having had such a much nicer life than normal. I should do that too. At least I seized the opportunity this past May to thank my birthplace. As a graduation speaker at Butler University, I said, if I had to do it all over, I would choose to be born again in a hospital in Indianapolis. I would choose to spend my childhood again at 4365 North Illinois Street, about 10 blocks from here, and to again be a product of that city's public schools. I would again take courses in bacteriology and quantitative analysis in the summer school of Butler University. It was all here for me, just as all here for you, the best and the worst of Western civilization, if you cared to pay attention. Music, finance, government, architecture, law and sculpture, and painting. History and medicine and athletics and every son of science and books and teachers and role models. People so smart you can't believe it, and people so dumb you can't believe it. People so nice you can't believe it, and people so mean you can't believe it. I gave advice, too. I said, my uncle Alex Vonnegut, a Harvard-educated life insurance salesman who lived at 5033 North Pennsylvania Street, taught me something very important. He said that when things were really going well, we should be sure to notice it. He was talking about simple occasions, not great victories. Maybe drinking lemonade on a hot afternoon in the shade, or smelling the aroma of a nearby bakery, or fishing, and not caring if we catch anything or not, or hearing somebody all alone playing a piano really well in the house next door. Uncle Alex urged me to say out loud during such epiphanies, well, if this isn't nice, what is? Another way I was lucky, for the first 33 years of my life, telling short stories with ink on paper was a major American industry. Although I then had a wife and two children, it made good business sense for me to quit my job as a publicity man for General Electric with health insurance and a retirement plan. I could make more money selling stories to the Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, weekly magazines full of ads which published five short stories and an installment of a cliff-hanging serial in every issue. Those were the top-paying buyers of what I could produce. There were so many other magazines hungry for fiction that the market for stories was like a pinball machine. When I mailed off a story to my agent, I could be pretty sure somebody would pay me something for it, even though it might be rejected again and again. But not long after, I moved my family from Schenectady to New York to Cape Cod Television, a much better buy for advertisers than magazines, made playing short-story pinball for a living obsolete. I commuted from the Cape to Boston to work for an industrial advertising agency and then became a dealer in Saab automobiles and then taught high school English in a private school for seriously fucked up rich kids. My son, the doctor, Mark Vonnegut, who wrote a swell book about his going crazy in the 1960s and then graduated from Harvard Medical School, had an exhibition of his watercolors in Milton, Massachusetts this summer. A reporter asked him what it had been like to grow up with a famous father. Mark replied, when I was growing up, my father was a car salesman who couldn't get a job teaching at Cape Cod Junior College. I still think up short stories from time to time, as though there were money in it. The habit dies hard. There used to be fleeting fame in it, too. Highly literate people once talked enthusiastically to one another about a story by Ray Bradbury or J.D. Salinger or John Cheever or John Collier or John O'Hara or Shirley Jackson or Flannery O'Connor or whomever, which had appeared in a magazine in the past few days. No more. All I do with short story ideas now is rough them out, credit them to Kilgore Trout, and put them in a novel. Here's the start of another one hacked from the carcass of Timequake One and entitled The Sisters B-36. On the matriarchal planet Boo Boo in the Crab Nebula, there were three sisters whose last name was B-36. It could only be a coincidence that their family name was also that of an Earthling airplane designed to drop bombs on civilian populations with corrupt leaderships. Earth and Boo Boo were too far apart to ever communicate. Another coincidence, the written language of Boo Boo was like English on Earth in that it consisted of idiosyncratic arrangements in horizontal lines of 26 phonetic symbols, 10 numbers, and about 8 punctuation marks. All three of the sisters were beautiful, so went Trout's tale, but only two of them were popular, one a picture painter and the other a short story writer. Nobody could stand the third one, who was a scientist. She was so boring. All she could talk about was thermodynamics. She was envious. Her secret ambition was to make her two artistic sisters feel, to use a favorite expression of Trout's, like something the cat drug in. Trout said boo-boolings were among the most adaptable creatures in the local family of galaxies. This was thanks to their great big brains, which could be programmed to do or not do, or feel or not feel, just about anything. You name it. The programming wasn't done surgically or electrically or by any other sort of neurological intrusiveness. It was done socially with nothing but talk, talk, talk. Grown-ups would speak to little boobalings favorably about presumably appropriate and desirable feelings and deeds. The brains of the youngsters would respond by growing circuits that made civilized pleasures and behavior automatic. It seemed a good idea, for example, when nothing much was really going on, for boobalings to be beneficially excited by minimal stimuli, such as idiosyncratic arrangements in horizontal lines of 26 phonetic symbols, 10 numbers, and 8 or so punctuation marks, or dabs of pigment on flat surfaces and frames. When a little boobaling was reading a book, a grown-up might interrupt to say, depending on what was happening in the book, "Isn't that sad? The little girl's nice little dog has just been run over by a garbage truck. Doesn't that make you want to cry?" But the grown-up might say about a very different sort of story, "Isn't that funny? When that conceited old rich man stepped on a nim-nim peel and fell into an open manhole, didn't that make you practically pop a gut laughing?" A nim-nim was a banana-like fruit on boo-boo. An immature boo-booing taken to an art gallery might be asked about a certain painting, whether the woman in it was really smiling or not. Couldn't she be sad about something and still look that way? Is she married, do you think? Does she have a kid? Is she nice to it? Where do you think she's going next? Does she want to go? If there was a bowl of fruit in the painting, a grown-up might ask, "Don't those nim-nims look good enough to eat? Yummy, yummy, yum." These examples of boobling pedagogy aren't mine. They're Kilgore Trout's. Thus were the brains of most, but not quite all, boobalings made to grow circuits, microchips, if you like, which on Earth would be called imaginations. Yes, and it was precisely because a vast majority of boobalings had imaginations that two of the B-36 sisters, the short story writer and the painter, were so beloved. The bad sister had an imagination all right, but not in the field of art appreciation. She wouldn't read books or go to art galleries. She spent every spare minute when she was little in the garden of a lunatic asylum next door. The psychos in the garden were believed to be harmless, so her keeping them company was regarded as a laudable, compassionate activity. But the nuts taught her thermodynamics and calculus and so on. When the bad sister was a young woman, she and the nuts worked up designs for television cameras and transmitters and receivers. Then she got money from her very rich mom to manufacture and market these satanic devices, which made imaginations redundant. They were instantly popular because the shows were so attractive and no thinking was involved. She made a lot of money, but what really pleased her was that her two sisters were starting to feel like something the cat drug in. Young boo-boolings didn't see any point in developing imaginations anymore, since all they had to do was turn on a switch and see all kinds of jazzy shit. They would look at a printed page or a painting and wonder how anybody could have gotten his or her rocks off looking at things that simple and dead. The bad sister's name was Nim-Nim. When her parents named her that, they had no idea how unsweet she was going to be, and TV wasn't the half of it. She was as unpopular as ever because she was as boring as ever, so she invented automobiles and computers and barbed wire and flamethrowers and landmines and machine guns and so on. That's how pissed off she was. New generations of boobalings grew up without imaginations. Their appetites for diversions from boredom were perfectly satisfied by all the crap Nim-Nim was selling them. Why not? What the heck? Without imaginations, though, they couldn't do what their ancestors had done, which was read interesting, heartwarming stories in the faces of one another. So according to Kilgore Trout, boobalings became among the most merciless creatures in the local family of galaxies. Trout said at the Clambake in 2001 that life was undeniably preposterous, but our brains are big enough to let us adapt to the inevitable pratfalls and buffoonery, he went on, by means of man-made epiphanies like this one. He meant the Clambake on a beach under a starry sky. "Well, if this isn't nice, what is?" he said. He declared the corn on the cob steamed in seaweed with lobsters and clams to be heavenly. He added, "And don't all the ladies look like angels tonight?" He was feasting on corn of the cob and women as ideas. He couldn't eat the corn because the upper plate of his false teeth was insecure. His long-term relationships with women had been disasters. In the only love story he ever attempted, "Kiss Me Again," he had written, "There is no way a beautiful woman can live up to what she looks like for any appreciable length of time. And the moral at the end of the story is this: men are jerks. Women are psychotic." Chief among man-made epiphanies for me have been, how much time do I have? Okay. Have been stage plays. Trout called them artificial timequakes. He said before Earthlings knew there was such a thing as timequakes in nature, they invented them, and it's true. Actors know everything that are going to say and do, and how everything is going to come out in the end, for good or ill, when the curtain goes up on Act 1, Scene 1. Yet they have no choice but to behave as though the future were a mystery. Yes, and when the timequake of 2001 zapped us back to 1991, it made 10 years of our pasts, 10 years of our futures, so we could remember everything we had to say and do again when the time came. Keep this in mind at the start of the next rerun after the next time quake. The show must go on. The artificial time quake that has moved me most so far this year is an old one. It is Our Town by the late Thornton Wilder. I had already watched it with undiminished satisfaction maybe 5 or 6 times. And in the spring, my 13-year-old daughter, dear Lily, was cast as a talking dead person in the graveyard of Grover's Corners in a school production of that innocent, sentimental masterpiece. The play zapped Lily and her schoolmates from the evening of the performance back to May 7, 1901. Timequake, they were robots of Thornton Wilder's imaginary past, until the curtain came down after the funeral of the heroine Emily in the very last scene. Only then could they live in 1996 again. Only then could they again decide for themselves what to say or do next. Only then could they exercise free will again. I reflected sadly that night, with Lily pretending to be a dead grown-up, that I would be 78 when she graduated from high school, and 82 when she graduated from college, and so on. Talk about remembering the future. What hit me really hard that night, though, was the character Emily's farewell in the last scene, after the mourners have gone back down the hill to their village, having buried her. She says, "Goodbye, goodbye, world. Goodbye, Grover's Corners, Mama and Papa. Goodbye to clocks ticking, and Mama's sunflowers, and food, and coffee, and new iron dresses and hot baths, and sleeping, and waking up. Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to realize you. Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it every minute?" I myself have become a sort of Emily every time I hear that speech. I haven't died yet, but there's a place, as seemingly safe and simple, as learnable, as acceptable as Grover's Corners at the turn of the century, with ticking clocks and Mama and Papa and hot baths and new iron clothes and all the rest of it, to which I've already said goodbye, one hell of a long time ago. Here's what that was. The first 7 years of my life, before the shit hit the fan, before the Great Depression, and then World War II. They say the first thing to go when you're old is your legs or your eyesight. It isn't true. The first thing to go is parallel parking. Now I find myself meandering around parts of plays hardly anybody knows or cares about anymore, such as the graveyard scene in Our Town, or the poker game in Tennessee Williams, A Streetcar Named Desire, or what Willie Loman's wife said after that tragically ordinary, clumsy, gallant gentleman committed suicide in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. She said, "Attention must be paid." In A Streetcar Named Desire, Blanche DuBois said as she was being taken away to a madhouse after she was raped by her sister's husband, "I have always depended on the kindness of strangers." Those speeches, those situations, those people became emotional and ethical landmarks for me in my early manhood and remained such in the summer of 1996. That is because I was immobilized in a congregation of rapt fellow human beings in the theater when I first saw and heard them. They would have made no more impression on me than Monday Night Football had I been alone eating nachos and gazing into the face of a cathode ray tube. In the early days of television, when there were only half a dozen channels at most, significant, well-written dramas on a cathode ray tube could still make us feel like members of an attentive congregation, alone at home as we might be. There was a high probability back then, with so few shows to choose from, that friends and neighbors were watching the same show we were watching, still finding a TV a whiz-bang miracle. We might even call up a friend that very night and ask a question to which we already knew the answer. "Did you see that? Wow!" No more. I wouldn't have missed the Great Depression or my part in World War II for anything. Crowd asserted at the clam bake that our war would live forever in showbiz, as other worlds would not because of the uniforms of the Nazis. He commented unfavorably on the camouflage suits of our own generals wear nowadays on TV when they describe our blasting the bejesus out of some third world country because of petroleum. "I can't imagine," he said, "any part of the world where such garish pajamas would make a soldier less rather than more visible. We're evidently preparing," he said, "to fight World War III in the midst of an enormous Spanish omelet." He asked what relatives of mine had been wounded in wars. As far as I knew, only one. That was my great-grandfather Peter Lieber, an immigrant who became a brewer in Indianapolis after being wounded in one leg during our Civil War. He was a freethinker, which is to say a skeptic about conventional religious beliefs, as had been Voltaire and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and so on, and as would be Kilgore Trout and I. I told Trout that Peter Lieber's Anglo-American Company commander gave his men, all freethinkers from Germany, Christian religious tracts of inspiration. Trout responded by giving his own revision of the book of Genesis. Fortunately, I had a tape recorder, which I turned on. "Please stop eating and pay attention," he said. "This is important." He paused to press the upper plate of his false teeth against the roof of his mouth with the ball of his left thumb. It would come unstuck every 2 minutes or so. He was left-handed, as I was until my parents made me switch, and as are my daughters Edith and Lily, or as we call them affectionately, Edie Bucket and Lolly Boo. "In the beginning, there was absolutely nothing, and I mean nothing," he said. "But nothing implies something, just as up implies down, and sweet implies sour, as man implies woman, and drunk implies sober, and happy implies sad. I hate to tell you this, friends and neighbors, but we are teensy-weensy implications in an enormous implication. If you don't like it here, why don't you go back to where you came from?" The first something to be implied by all the nothing, he said, was in fact two somethings, who were God and Satan. God was male, Satan was female. They implied each other, and hence were peers in the emerging power structure, which was itself nothing but an implication. Power was implied by weakness. God created the heaven and the earth, the old long-out-of-print science fiction writer went on, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved among the face of the waters. Satan could have done this herself, but she thought it was stupid. Action for the sake of action, what was the point? She didn't say anything at first. But Satan began to worry about God when he said, "Let there be light," and there was light. She had to wonder, what the heck does he think he's doing? How far does he intend to go, and does he expect me to help him take care of all this crazy stuff? And then the shit really hit the fan. God made man and woman, beautiful little miniatures of him and her, and turned them loose to see what might become of them. The Garden of Eden, said Trout, might be considered the prototype for the Colosseum and the Roman Games. Satan, he said, couldn't undo anything God had done. She could at least try to make existence for his little toys less painful. She could see what he couldn't. To be alive was to be either bored or scared stiff. So she filled an apple with all sorts of ideas that might at least relieve the boredom, such as rules for games with cards and dice, and how to fuck, and recipes for beer and wine and whiskey, and pictures of different plants that were smokable, and so on, and instructions on how to make music and sing and dance really crazy, real sexy, and how to spout blasphemy when they stub their toes. Satan had a serpent give Eve the apple. Eve took a bite and handed it to Adam. He took a bite, and then they fucked. "I grant you," said Trout, "that some of the ideas in that apple had catastrophic side effects for a minority of those who tried them." Let it be noted here that Trout himself was not an alcoholic, a junkie, a gambler, or a sex fiend. He just wrote. All Satan wanted to do is help, and she did in many cases, he concluded, and her record for promoting nostrums with occasionally dreadful side effects is no worse than that of the most reputable pharmaceutical houses of the present day. Side effects of Satan's booze recipes have played a deleterious part in the lives and deaths of many great American writers. In Timequake 1, I envisioned a writer's retreat called Xanadu, where each of the four guest suites was named in honor of an American winner of a Nobel Prize for Literature. The Ernest Hemingway suite, the Eugene O'Neill suite, were on the second floor of the mansion. The Sinclair Lewis was on the third. The John Steinbeck was on the carriage house. Kilgore Trout exclaimed upon arriving at Xanadu 2 weeks after Free Will kicked in again, "All four of your ink on paper heroes were certifiable alcoholics." Gambling ruined William Saravan. A combination of booze and gambling did end the journalist Alvin Davis, a much friend of mine. I asked Al one time what was the biggest kick he got from Games of Chance. He said it came after he had lost all of his money in an around-the-clock poker game. He went back after a few hours of money he had gotten wherever he could get it, from a friend, from hawking something, from a loan shark, and he sat down at the table and said, "Deal me in." The late British philosopher Bertrand Russell said he lost friends to one of three addictions, alcohol or religion or chess. Kilgore Trout was hooked on making idiosyncratic arrangements in horizontal lines with ink on bleached and flattened wood pulp of 26 phonetic symbols, 10 numbers, and about 8 punctuation marks. He was a black hole to anyone who might imagine that he or she was a friend of his. "I have been married twice, divorced once. Both my wives, Jane and now Jill, have said on occasion that I am much like Trout in that regard." We're out of time. We've been reading from Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s last novel, Timequake, which has been our sacred text of the evening. Join us next week for our regularly scheduled structured mayhem. on the Crystal Silence League Hour. I am, of course, as always, John St. Germain, and we are brought to you by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company and the LMC Radio Network. Following this is In the Streets with Beverly Smith. And goodbye, all. See you next week. Thank you.